Welcome to Pound the Rock, the Scores NBA podcast. I'm Joe Wolfond, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Joseph Cacciaro. Talk to me, Cash.
Talk to me, Wolfond. What are we discussing today?
Oh, you just want to dive right in, eh? No pleasantries, no preamble.
You want to shoot the shit for a little while? What's on your mind non-basketball related?
Well, you know, we're approaching MLB season, and I'm just frustrated by our beloved Toronto Blue Jays, Cash. Just a disastrous offseason, and now Danny Jansen is somehow on the IL for the 800th time after getting hit by a pitch and breaking his hand.
Made of glass.
But we can dispense with the pleasantries and just get right into our topic du jour. I want to talk about a couple teams today that we haven't spoken about them in depth at various points throughout the season, but as we kind of ramp up for the playoffs, we had an episode where we talked about the most confusing teams in the league, an episode where we talked about the most stable teams in the league, and these two teams did not get mentioned in either of those conversations, but I do think if we're thinking about the playoffs and teams that are maybe not in that inner circle of contenders, but that have given us reason to believe that they could play the role of playoff spoiler, it's got to be the Dallas Mavericks and Miami Heat. And that just lines up perfectly in my mind because I feel like for whatever reason, we always find a way to talk about these two teams in conjunction. They're just spiritually linked. The two finals appearances against one another, they're kind of like mirror images of one another. You have like the Heat who are always airtight defensively, but the question is like, can they figure things out at the offensive end? And it's funny, like the playoffs where they always have this glow up seemingly every year. I feel like it is on offense where they always manage to level up. And then on the other hand, you have Dallas, an offensive juggernaut that has this question every year of whether they can do enough defensively to keep them in that conversation. And the one year that they made it to the conference finals, they were a really strong defensive team. So Mavs and Heat, playoff spoilers, question mark. What do you think, Cash? Where do you want to start?
Let's start with Dallas since we both just watched them last night. I mean, without Luka Doncic, lose to Oklahoma City, which was predictable. I guess the difficulty I'm having considering either of these two teams potential playoff spoilers is how underwhelmed I've been by both for the most part this season. But I do see where you're coming from, and I do understand why we're talking about them within this context because, I mean, you know, we don't have to get into for the 400th time how the Heat have, as you mentioned, had that kind of postseason glow up the last few years and why they're always a different team come April, May, and potentially June. And then from the Mavs perspective, like, you have a talent like Luka Doncic out there for 40 minutes a night in the playoffs, you have a puncher's chance at least. And so, yeah, I can't dismiss either team as a potential spoiler. We can start with the Mavs because they're the freshest in my mind. They're one of these teams, obviously, with the Suns, the Lakers, the Warriors, the Kings, the Pelicans, where right now the Mavs are in eighth. They're 9 games over 500, 38 and 29, but they can realistically finish anywhere from 5th to 10th if you look at the standings. By the way, if the season ended today, the play-in matchups would be Mavs-Suns renewing their rivalry and the Doncic-Booker rivalry, and then Lakers-Warriors in the 9-10. Nerve-wracking for the fan bases of those four teams, but the NBA, you know, just looking at things preliminarily right now, gotta be frothing at the mouth with those potential play-in matchups. Anyway.
And over in the East, we would have a scintillating Hawks-Bulls 9-10 matchup that I'm sure everyone would be just as excited for.
Yeah. Anyway, the Mavs, obviously, one of the, if you just go by what they did at the deadline, talent-wise, everything, one of the most improved teams at the deadline. And just looking at who they brought in, what or who was sent out, they're 9-6 since the deadline. In all honesty, they're play hasn't changed much, and their performance hasn't changed much. I mean, they were a 556 team before the break. Now they're a 600 team since, 9-6, small sample. But like, the only thing that's really changed is that their offense looks more like the juggernaut it should be and you'd expect from a team that has Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, right? It was 12th pre-deadline. It's been a top three offense since. The defense is basically the exact same. It was 23rd before the deadline. It's been 22nd since. And look, Daniel Gafford has fit in perfectly and then some. I know he just had that streak where he made 33 straight field goals over a span of five and a little bit games. It ended last night, I think, before he could match Wilt Chamberlain's record. I think he didn't match Wilt.
He came up two field goals short.
There you go. But yeah, listen, Gafford has done his job and then some. Like, perfect partner for Luka Doncic as a guy who's just going to like screen, roll, finish at the rim, block shots, do his job defensively. He's not like the greatest rim protector, but
well, I think he is a really good rim protector. I just think it's when he was defending and drop,
yes,
that it's a little bit tenuous. Like, he's not an ace when it comes to angles and positioning. He gets caught in between a lot of the time where he's like not really helping on the ball handler, but also getting beat by the roll man behind him. So that's what I'd point to. But I think he's been good, to your point.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the way I'd rephrase it is good rim protector, obviously inflated block numbers, not the overall big man defender maybe that you'd expect when you look at the block totals, but overall I think solid and obviously great rebounder. Like I said, the perfect partner for Luka Doncic, has done his job. PJ Washington, I think, a little more disappointing. But even in the case of Gafford, the problem, again, as we've talked about so many times over the last few years, is that even when the Mavs make a move that you can look at and be like, okay, this makes sense just strictly from like a did they get better, yes or no, yes, they got better. But it's they always kind of seem to make these incremental upgrades in the short term that are not worth the long-term cost. And this was another example where it's like, you know, as we discussed, in order to land Gafford, or in order to nab the draft pick that they then used to get Gafford, the Mavs gave the Thunder first round swap rights in 2028 to get PJ Washington. They gave up a 2027 first rounder that's only top two protected. This follows a pattern of the kinds of moves they've been making over the last few years that you can trace it all the way back to the Porzingis deal if you want. Even Kyrie, like the Kyrie deal has worked obviously mostly fine. And in fact, right now, Kyrie Irving is in the midst of an 18 consecutive game streak that marks his longest streak of appearances and games played since he made 22 consecutive appearances at the start of the 2016-17 season. Kyrie Irving right now has played the most consecutive games he has in like 7.5 years. And he's been really friggin' good. That's another deal. You'd be like, yeah, that mostly worked. But if you go through the whole chain of events, it's like, well, the only reason they needed to do that though and give him more draft capital is because of the way they botched the Jalen Brunson situation. So it's this vicious cycle where I know.
Also, the Porzingis trade, not the one to get him, but the one where they got rid of him. Because they went and made the conference finals that year, it just doesn't get dragged as much as it should. But that was a horrible, horrible trade. And it's like, if you take it in totality, like imagine if they just had Brunson and Porzingis right now and all of the draft capital that they wouldn't have had to expend in order to rectify those mistakes. Like, it's, yeah, like, again, a lot of moves that sort of in a vacuum you can rationalize. And then when you look at the entire picture, it is such a mess.
Yeah, and like, you know, I've talked about it before how, and I don't even want to get into the whole like, you know, Luka's future and all that, but it more so just, I've talked about how I feel the way the Mavs have operated for the majority of the Luka era, they have somewhat wasted the head start that having a player like that is supposed to give you. And I think that's kind of still bearing true this season. We're like, yeah, they're good. But if you just, you look at the moves they've made, you look at the trade capital and draft equity they've given up over the last X number of years to just get to a spot where like their third best player is either Daniel Gafford or maybe a guy who just got out of his teens and Derek Lively. I mean, maybe some would say PJ Washington. I don't believe that based on the fact
you know who I think is actually the third best player right now? Dante Exum.
Okay.
And that is, you know, maybe damning him with faint praise or maybe more of a slight to the Mavericks than it is like, but he's been really good.
When
he's been healthy.
But again, you know, all the credit in the world to him in kind of rebuilding his NBA career, kind of learning how to shoot while back in Europe. But again, if Dante Exum is your third best player, after all of the moves you've made over the last few years and all of the draft capital trade, like, man, that's a really sobering realization to come to. And even if you just want to look at, okay, forget the future, forget the draft picks, just we're talking about this Mavs team in 2023-24 and what they are right now, what they look like, I still just don't have much faith in their postseason ceiling, because as incredible a season as Luka Doncic is having and as insane a basketball player as he is, as good as Kyrie looks right now and as healthy as he looks, it's still like, in this Western Conference that we just talked about, what even the play-in tournament looks like, absolutely stacked, this team just doesn't have enough and their defense is nowhere good enough for me to have any faith that they can, you know, beat one of the better teams in the West 4-7, let alone beat two or three of them. Am I being too hard on them from your vantage point, or are you in the same boat as me?
No, I mean, look, when I'm talking about playoff spoiler, I'm not necessarily talking about going on a run, making the finals, winning a title. I'm more thinking like, look, they're going to wind up in the bottom half of the bracket. That's at best, you know, that's if they make it out of the play-in. And I do think, you know, looking at it now, they to me are by far the most likely team of that four-team play-in group that you mentioned to make it into the top six. Okay. We talked last night about the Suns' schedule down the stretch. And by the way, look, I'm not going to overreact to a game against the Celtics because they're a buzzsaw. They've been beating up on everybody. But more just like an accumulation of this feeling that I've been having as I've watched them over the past few weeks, even as they've gotten fully healthy, I think I'm finally ready to remove contender status from that team. I just am not seeing it at all. And it's like for a team with that much offensive firepower, that much shooting, that much shot creation, it's a little jarring watching them and seeing how few really high quality shots they actually generate. And maybe that's just like a KD thing. Like, I'm a little concerned, as amazing as he's been, as durable as he's been, like, he doesn't really seem at this stage to be able to create a lot of very good shots for himself. I don't know. I watch their offense, which is supposed to be their bread and butter, and I come away feeling very underwhelmed. And I think they've been actually like pretty good defensively for the season. Like, they're in the top half, but it doesn't feel convincing. You don't feel like they play with a lot of force, or like the opposing offense ever really feels them in a meaningful physical kind of way. And I don't think they're a contender. So there you go. I've been clinging to that, being like, just let me see them get whole. And now I've seen it, and I'm not really buying it.
Yeah, I think this team has had fraud alert written all over them all season. And like, you talk about like the quality of shots they're getting. This was an issue last year, right? Like, we talked about it. Everyone talked about it. I think when we wrote our annual kind of like fatal flaw for every contender series, I wrote about the Suns and how, for as talented as Kevin Durant and Devin Booker are, and as great as they are, you know, at being tough shot makers and shot creators, it's really rare to win in the playoffs with their shot profile and like not getting to the rim at all and all that. And then when they traded for Bradley Beal, you know, part of the reasoning, or at least some of the reasoning people tried to find, was he can do some things to maybe unclog the offense a little bit. He actually can get to the rim and get their drive numbers up. But like, for the most part, whether it's Beal just not being in the lineup often enough, or you know, not playing with the other guys often enough, to your point, it hasn't really greased the wheels of the offense in ways people thought it would, where they would just be this absolute unstoppable offensive juggernaut that could maybe override the defensive concerns. It's funny how it's played out. Anyway, just quickly, because you mentioned their schedule, you know, that we discussed last night. So 12 of their final 16 games against winning teams, and 10 of their final 16 games on the road for a team that's already in eighth place. That's tough. I think they end up in that 9-10 and then just like you know, assuming they're even intact by the time the play-in tournament gets here. It's just a really uphill battle for a team that a lot of people assumed were just auto contenders coming into the year.
I got us way off track. But my point is, I think Dallas is the most likely team in that group to get up into the top six. But even if they don't, if they just make it through the play-in, when I talk about spoiler, I'm thinking, can this team upset one of the top four teams in the West? We've had this clear top four in the West the entire season, right? And if I'm one of those four teams, I mean, I don't think there's necessarily any team in the bottom half of the bracket that I'm excited to play in the first round. But yeah, going up against Luka and the Mavs would scare me. I think they would have to be on upset alert at the very least. So I'm not talking about, you know, can the Mavs make a run, be a real true blue championship contender? I'm more just thinking, can they play spoiler and knock one of these top teams off in one of the earlier rounds? And I think, obviously, with what Luka has done in the playoffs in the past, but just he's better than ever right now, right? Like 34, 9, and 10 is what he's averaging. I'm rounding up or down with his scoring average and rounding up on the assists. But like that's basically what he's averaging, 34, 9, and 10. Like a rebound away from averaging a 34-point triple-double. And the big thing to me that we've talked about off-air and that I don't know if it's really gotten enough attention, he's at 58% from two-point range, which is where he was at last year, but 38% this year on 10 three-point attempts per game. And that three-point consistency that we just haven't seen from him in the past changes everything. And I still, if I have a quibble about Luka's offensive game, it is the fact that he, to me, resorts to that step back three a little bit too often, especially when he gets a big man switched onto him. Like if you're an opposing team, I actually think just switching with your big is a very viable defensive strategy against Luka, because he is almost always going to fall back on that step back three. And it's like, yeah, he'll hit a bunch of those, but if that's what he's going to do, I feel like that's a shot you'll live with compared to what he can do if you're like putting two on the ball or playing drop against him. So that's, I guess, a stylist or like a tactical quibble that I have. But also, if he's hitting 38% of his threes and taking 10 a game, then that strategy can still pay off for him in Dallas. So there's that. Obviously, the passing, like his eye manipulation is just second to none. If there is a defense that's moving, that's in rotation, that's having to bring guys over to tag or try to pre-rotate, he will just cook that almost every time, and he will use his eyes to move defenders exactly where he wants them to go before slinging an absolute dart to the open man. And he's just been so unbelievably good at that this year. I also think like his hit-ahead passing and outlet passing has gone up another level this year. And with the Mavs playing with a little bit more pace, that's really gotten to shine through. So just watching him, I'm like, how can you not believe in this team in a playoff environment, at least as like a potential first round spoiler? And especially with Kyrie beside him, and like you said, playing consistently, flirting with 50-40-90 himself, playing really, really well. It comes back to the defense, right? Is there enough here with Exum, who, as I mentioned, I think has maybe been the Mavs' third best player, defending extremely well and like hitting 48% of his threes, Cash. And a really important thing, I remember talking about this last year when they got Kyrie and they weren't really using Luka and Kyrie in a lot of actions together. Because I think the dirty little secret of having your two best offensive players be anything other than like a guard and a center is like, the opposing team is going to have its two best defenders guarding your two best offensive players, and using them in actions together doesn't always work that well because it's just going to be a switch and you're not necessarily going to gain a big advantage from that. So even look at Boston, right? Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum don't interact in cooperative actions that much. Instead, what really works for them is like Derek White, Jason Tatum actions, and Derek White, Kristaps Porzingis actions, and Jaylen Brown, Kristaps Porzingis actions, right? that doesn't mean they can't complement each other or help each other out. It just means they don't run a lot of pick and roll together or even like off-ball screening actions together. But when you have a guy like Exum, who the defense is very likely to hide its weakest defender on, and you can have him screen and roll and make plays on the short roll and then also pop and actually hit threes, that is monumental. So that's been big for them on offense, and he is maybe their best perimeter defender as well. So between him, Derek Jones Jr., who's also hit like a surprising number of threes this year to remain viable offensively, Kleba, Gafford, Josh Green, Lively, is there enough here? You know, like, because I think given their personnel, they could get up to like average-ish if they cleaned up some of their mistakes. Because like with a team like this, if you're going to be at that level, like average or better, you got to play like really clean, mistake-free defense. And the Mavs don't do that. It's not just a physical issue or an issue yeah. like them not having high-level defenders. It's also about they have miscommunications and coverage breakdowns all the time. Like Tim Hardaway Jr. gets back cut, I want to say, more than any player in the league. And they have a lot of situations where one guy thinks it's a switch and another guy thinks they're staying and somebody pops wide open as a result of that. It's like, if they could clean that stuff up, then I think they could actually be something like an average defense. But that's a tall task, especially at this point of the season, to just flip that switch. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That's obviously where the questions are basically going to start and end.
How do you feel about an Irving, Exum, Doncic, Green, Gafford lineup? Do you think that leaves them without enough size? Because you essentially got
like Luka playing the four. Basically. I was going to say
defensively, your front court is Doncic or like Green, Doncic, Gafford.
I mean, I don't hate it. It's going to depend on the opponent at the end of the day, but. Like, yeah, that I think it could work, especially if, like, there are a lot of times where Luka will basically just be playing a one-man zone on defense, like standing in the lane and tag switching onto whoever passes through the lane and then point switching everybody else so he doesn't have to move at all on defense. And he's a really big dude. So, like, I've heard a lot of people talk about, well, Luka's so much improved defensively this season, and I can't say I've really seen that, but because of his size, he's never going to be as much of a liability on that end as like some of the other heliocentric guard operators in the league. And that's the kind of thing you can do with him where, yeah, he's not going to be great at like chasing dudes around, but if you just park him in the lane, he can be a deterrent because he's huge. So I think depending on the opponent, that could work. And I will say, look, I think the PJ Washington experience, I don't want to speak for Mavs fans, but just as a non-partial observer watching them, has been extremely frustrating because, as I said when they got him, the idea of him as a stretch four is a lot greater than the reality of him as a stretch four. And the number of times that like Luka or Kyrie has made some dazzling play or some incredible pass to spoon feed him a wide open corner three that he clanks is like, it's too many to count. But NBA.com tracks wide open threes where the defender is at least 6 feet away from you when you shoot. He's getting more of those wide open threes than any other player on the Mavs, and he's hitting 27% of them in Dallas. So that's been frustrating, but I will say he's been a lot better defensively than I expected him to be, and that matters. Like if some more of those wide open threes start dropping, I do think, you know, you can compare him to Grant Williams, who was hitting 40% of his wide open threes before he got run out of town. At least PJ can do a little bit more inside the arc. He can drive a closeout when he's playing with Kleba, and that's a front court that Jason Kidd has gone to a lot and likes to close with. In spite of them giving up what they gave up to get another traditional center in Gafford, they like going to that Washington Kleba front court to close games. And in that alignment, you can get more of the like rim rolling stuff that PJ Washington's actually really good at, like better at than this, like spotting up and serving as a stretch four. So if he can do that and keep defending at the level he's been defending at, then there's definitely a key role for him. And I would imagine, in spite of the lineup that you just threw out, which I think does have a lot of promise, I do think you're going to run into some size issues with that. And PJ is going to have to factor in somewhere, but he's got to hit some of these shots.
I know making grand statements like this about like line, it's like maybe a little ridiculous because you don't know about matchups. You don't know about any of that. And I get that, there are probably some matchups and some playoff settings where you want more of a five out look, but I think it will be a tremendous mistake if the Mavs get to the playoffs and they're not starting, I don't care, but like they're not closing games and playing a majority of minutes with one of Lively or Gafford on the court. If both of those guys are on the bench in big moments in the playoffs and close like crunch time in the playoffs, I think that's a tremendous mistake.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'll say is before last night's game, which I think you can to a certain extent toss away because Luka's not playing, that front court was a disaster last night, and I'm really surprised that they didn't go back to Gafford to close because he was actually very good. Mm-hmm. Up until then, they'd been incredible with the Kleba PJ Washington front court, something like plus 19 or plus 18 points per 100 possessions in like over 100 minutes together. So it's been working, but I tend to agree with you. And it's also just like from a process perspective, you know, you went out and you gave up a really juicy asset to get Daniel Gafford. And after they got him, we're talking and it's like they have now basically 48 minutes of true center play covered where they're going to have an athletic rim running above the rim finishing big man on the floor for the entire game. And it's interesting that in spite of that, they have continued to lean on Kleba at center as much as they have. And I understand the benefits that they get from that, both in terms of like switchability defensively and spacing offensively. But yeah, you know, Kleba is just, he's such a bystander on offense. Like he's just not involved at all. And as much as he can maybe open up some more for PJ doing, you know, more of the things that he's good at inside the arc, I don't know if that's enough of a reason to play him at five as much as they've been doing when you have these two other really good options. And like we mentioned Gafford, some of the defensive limitations there, but he really can protect the rim and he just inhales offensive rebounds, you know, on top of being a really tremendous finisher. So that's the only thing where I'm like, because this is what I wrote this. We had a piece, a joint byline that we published about the traded players and how they've fared. And something I mentioned in there is like, okay, you traded this juicy asset for Daniel Gafford. He's played pretty well, but he's playing 18 minutes a game and Jason Kidd does not trust him in big spots.
It's
so
strange.
What are we doing here? And I got a lot of blowback from some Mavs fan commenters being like, well, Gafford's been incredible. And since he got into the starting lineup, they haven't lost until last night. And he has been playing more lately. So I recognize that this has started to change, but the point was more if the coach doesn't trust him and he's just still playing basically backup minutes, then why did you expend like a really vital draft asset to get this guy? How the center rotation shakes out is also going to be super interesting to me down the stretch and moving into the playoffs.
One quick note I did want to mention is like, because you know there's that conversation out there about like especially with, I don't know if disgruntled is the right word, but how Kristaps Porzingis maybe didn't take to his role beside or in a Luka-centric system the way the Mavs hoped. And then the way obviously Jalen Brunson, who was already good in Dallas, like just exploded into stardom in New York. You know, there was a bit of that narrative of like maybe Luka somehow like suppresses the output of fellow stars or like teammates. And then there's the narrative about like guys who don't want to play with him because he dominates the ball so much. I'm not going to pretend to know how much of that is true, if at all. But I will say the player type that absolutely should want to play with Luka, and I assume does, is are you a big man who can just set a screen, roll hard to the rim, and catch a basketball? Because if you are, I think you are the guys that definitely want to play with Luka and squash this narrative that like, oh, guys don't. I know the narrative is more about like fellow stars and anyone who wants a little more of the ball, but still, like, if you are a big man out there, you don't even have to be in the NBA. Are you a large human who can set a screen and catch a basketball? Because if so, Luka Doncic might be able to help you average a double-double.
Might be able to help you make 33 field goals
in a row.
Yeah. And also, I mean, like the Kyrie-Gafford pick and roll has also been really good. Like, I don't want to skip past Kyrie's role in that, but yeah. And not to belabor the Porzingis point too much, because we have receipts, man. You can go back to our episode at the time they made that trade, and we were very down on it. So it's not like this is revisionist history. I don't know that he ever could have gotten to the level that he's at right now if he had stayed in Dallas. But it is just funny thinking about the Mavs trying to balance, you know, the offense and the defense and the different looks that they can have with their center rotation. And they had this dude who could give them the rim protection element, give them a defensive anchor while also allowing them to get to five out spacing. They had that dude on the roster and they traded him for Spencer Dinwiddie and Davis Bertans. Is that right? Was that the deal? Was there anything else attached?
The whole revisionist history, but like playing Monday morning quarterback, but imagine Luka right now with Jalen Brunson and Kristaps Porzingis. All right.
That's what I was saying.
I'll stop. I'll stop. Actually, I won't stop because I do want to point out one more thing. I mentioned it when we did that project, you know, the top 25 players of the last 25 years. And because there was some pushback about having Luka in there, given how early in his career he is. And my whole thing was like, dude, he's been a top five level player already for a longer period of time than some Hall of Famers. Assuming he can just play seven more games this year, get to 65 games, then he'll shoe in for another All-NBA first team selection, which will be his fifth in the first 6 years of his career. If and when that happens, Luka Doncic, through six seasons, will be tied for 21st all-time in All-NBA first team selections with Dwight Howard, Jason Kidd, Charles Barkley, Julius Erving, George Gervin, Rick Barry, and George Mikan.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Okay, so final verdict. The Mavericks, potential playoff spoiler. They wind up, you know, whether it's six or seven, they're going up against, you know, the Thunder or the Wolves. Are they a serious threat to take down one of those teams?
I'd kind of chalk it up to what you said earlier. Like, I think, and what I said, that you have Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving. In a small sample, you know, 4 to 7 games, you've got a chance, for sure. You've got a puncher's chance. I will not take that away from them. How serious of a threat are they? I'm not very convinced. Obviously, so much is matchup dependent. Okay, my question for you before I guess we get to the break and move on to Miami is, so Oklahoma City, Denver, Minnesota, Clippers, those are the top four, right? Does one of those four teams stand out to you as a team that is maybe ripe for the picking for Dallas, that for whatever reason, matchup wise, you'd be like, if the Mavs have a real chance to win a first round series, this is the matchup they should be hoping for. And throw injuries out of the way. Like, obviously, if Towns isn't backward, I'm saying if imagine each team at full strength.
I guess the Thunder. And that's I would pick the Thunder to win that series, to be clear, but maybe the Clippers, like they've had success against the Clippers in the playoffs in the past, even though they haven't actually beaten them in the series, they've come very close. I don't know. They have Kawhi and PG to throw at, or they probably put Terrence Mann actually on Kyrie. Or are they honestly, would they even start games with Kawhi guarding Luka? Maybe not.
Probably not, but they'd go to it when needed.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know, that makes me scratch my head, but also I think, you know, there are maybe certain matchup advantages that Dallas could get there. But with OKC, just watching last night, they have Gafford guarding Giddy. I thought, I don't want to get into a whole Thunder discussion. I did think the Thunder had some good counters for that, but in the half court specifically, that worked out pretty well for Dallas. And I think Gafford in that roamer role was quite good. You know, and then they have some defensive answers they can throw at, Shea shook loose late in that game, but Derrick Jones Jr. did a pretty good job on him. You know, Exum in spots can do a decent job on him. Like, you're never going to hold Shea, but they have some answers there. And then with Gafford there, he was, again, just vacuuming up offensive rebounds against a team that struggles on the defensive glass. I guess I would just think, are there more advantages? Is it tougher for OKC to match up with Dallas than vice versa. I don't think I can get all the way there, but if I'm looking at one matchup where that's maybe going to be the case, I feel like that is probably the one. How about you?
I don't think I can come up with one of those four that I'm like, I don't think either, like, any of those four is a good matchup or close to a good matchup for Dallas.
Yeah, fair enough. But I mean, it's almost like not even about that. It's just like how nuclear can Luka go?
Right.
And, you know, is that going to be enough to overcome whatever cracks there are in their defensive foundation? And there are many, but like I said, if they clean up some of the mistakes, get them to a place where their defense is like in the average range. And if you're in the average range and you have an offense that's proven capable of being one of the three best units in the league, then you've got a fighting chance against pretty much anybody. That's all we're talking about. And I would give them a shot against any of these teams, actually, except for Denver.
Agreed. I'll agree. Like, they at least have a, like I've been saying, a puncher's chance. But you give me Mavs, Denver, both teams at full strength, I'm not even giving them a puncher's chance.
Yeah. Okay, that's enough time on Dallas. Let's take the break. We'll come back and we'll talk about Miami.
What's up, Pound the Rock listeners? Just a friendly reminder to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also check out the Scores Fantasy Football Podcast with Justin Boone. And in case you haven't already, download the Score app, available on iPhone and Android. That's where you can find all of our feature content, as well as live scores, updates, and breaking news. And don't forget to check out the Score's YouTube page for an informative yet lighthearted dive into the sports world's trending topics. Now back to the show.
All right, Cash. The Miami Heat, the roughest, toughest, meanest, best conditioned, nastiest, manly, full of testosterone fucking team in the NBA. They're barely above water in terms of their point differential. I think they're 35 and 30. Like we said at the top, kind of a mirror image of Dallas, where you definitely trust their defense, but they are 22nd in offense, and among current playoff teams, only the Magic are worse. And on that note, Cash, I'm sorry, but your bold prediction at the start of the season about the Magic finally finishing in the top 20 in offensive rating, don't think that one's going to come to fruition, sorry to say. But only the Magic among playoff teams are worse than Miami offensively. And it's just been like a real roller coaster season for the Heat. Like, they started off, I think, you know, they won their first game, then they lost four in a row right away. Then they won seven in a row right away. A little while after that, they lost seven straight. Then immediately after that, they won 11 of their next 14. And now immediately after that, they've lost their last four. So it's just all over the place. And I can't decide how seriously to take them, because everything we've talked about, like, they are 6-2, like I've said before, against the other four teams that we would consider like major contenders in the East, other than the Cavs. They haven't played the Cavs in the playoffs in the last four postseasons, but against the Knicks, Sixers, Celtics, and Bucks in the last four playoffs, they are 6-2 in those eight series. Beating the Bucks twice, beating the Celtics twice. How much are we just leaning on precedent here and ignoring the evidence in front of our faces that they are just not that good a team? I know we've seen this movie before, but like, the other movie we've seen before is they looked like this kind of mid team back in, what was it, 2021, right? When the Bucks went on to win the championship, and they get the Bucks matchup in the first round. Jimmy Butler comes out. He's like, I am stupidly locked in. And then he had the worst playoff series of his life and they got swept. You know, are we headed that way? Or is this going to be another situation where the devil magic returns and none can stand before it?
All right, there's a lot to unpack there and to answer. I will start by saying I actually don't think their manifesto is that toxic. I think, I think that as kind of cringe and corny as it may sound, and as many eye rolls as it induces around the league, I think it's actually kind of fun that they lean into it and own it. And I think they know that there is, like,
of course you think that,
no, but I think they know too that it's more so like it's almost like they're trolling other teams. That's one. In terms of your question, look, are we leaning on precedent here? Yeah, we are. And is it also possible that it could go the way it went a couple of years ago or 3 years ago, whenever it was, when they were mid and then they looked terrible in the playoffs and got their asses handed to them by Milwaukee? Sure. But the point of it is using the precedents available to us when it comes to the Miami Heat and the Jimmy Butler era Miami Heat especially means that all things are possible. And that, not that the regular season doesn't matter, but that, like, them looking mid all year, being inconsistent all year, never really looking as good as the sum of their parts, whatever, doesn't matter as much as it does with other teams. Like, at this point, that's just a fact. Using the regular season to evaluate a team's level of contention, postseason ceiling, whatever, does not align with the Miami Heat the way it does with other teams. You just can't do it the way you can with other teams. And yeah, that we're relying on precedent, but, like, it's a pretty big precedent now that, and a big sample that we have to rely on. So I don't know what's going to happen in the playoffs, but I can tell you, as I've told you off air, I think I'd pick them in a series against Milwaukee right now. And I'll give them, you know, that puncher's chance I talked about with Luka and the Mavs. It's like, I've said it almost every single year we've had this conversation now when you talk about the devil magic, and I always love when you do have the conversation, but I'll, like, say it again. I really don't even think it's that complicated or shiesty. Like, it's just that you have a player in Jimmy Butler who is capable of being an alpha superstar, like the championship level superstar. You've got arguably, and I think we'd both agree, probably the best coach in basketball right now. The guy who makes the best in-game and in-series adjustments. You've got a team that we know when the chips are down can defend. And you put all that together, and that is always a team that is going to have a chance in any playoff series. I don't care what the overall talent disparity is between two teams. And so, like, to me, it's not about devil magic. It's about those factors. And those factors still align for this year. So they're still very capable, especially in a crappy East again, or at least the bottom half of it, like, of finding the right matchup, winning a series, and then all bets are off with this team against everyone but maybe Boston. So I don't know if that answered your question. That's just me kind of talking my way through things and being like, yeah, it could go the way it went a few years ago where it's like, you know, they very much look like a 7 seed, an 8 seed, whatever they are, if and when they get to the playoffs. But I think the larger sample size here suggests to us that they're going to look more consistent than this and just a lot better than this when the playoffs roll around and they find their way in, even if it's through the play-in. And then at that point, you know, you got to give them a shot. Right now they're in 8th, obviously they're in that play-in range. But if you look at just like where they are in the standings in terms of games behind and all that, they're in 8th, but they are closer to 4th place New York than they are to 9th place Chicago. They're only 3 games back in the loss column of 4th. Do I think they're going to get there? No. But for all the talk of them having to go through the play-in again, and yes, if it ended right now, they would. They're still very much in contention to, forget, just avoid the play-in. Like, they're still in contention to have home court advantage in the first round if they catch a heater. Now, maybe it's hard to envision that because they're 11-14 over the last 25. You mentioned they've lost 4 straight, which includes a home loss to the league worst Wizards. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you did answer my question. And, like, you know, I understand. You cannot divorce this team from that context and from the history that we have cited. But I want to try and just look at what we've actually seen this season and talk about what about what they've done and how they've looked this year would give us optimism or skepticism about how everything translates or doesn't translate to the playoffs. Because, look, I think with Jimmy specifically, he has these bouts of passivity, and I just don't know what to do with that. But I think that's the one where it's like precedent would tell you, don't pay attention to that. In the playoffs, he will do what he needs to do. There's a lot of like selective aggression with Jimmy, I think, where he knows how to pace himself, knows how to meet the moment. And if he is needed, like if the Heat need him to score 40 points, he'll find a way to do that. So I'm not paying too much attention to that, but I am, it's in the back of my head a little bit because I don't know that in past seasons, it's been quite to this level where they have kind of needed him to like take over games down the stretch and he hasn't quite been able to find that gear. And he's just not, this is like a team-wide problem, and it has been, where they just like don't apply nearly enough pressure on the rim. They are, let me look quickly, 29th in rim frequency this year. Just ahead, a hair ahead of Dallas, who's 28th. He, in the past, has been the guy who like can apply that pressure when they need him to. So I'm keeping that in the back of my head, especially because, you know, the Heat are 12-7 without him this year. And given that fact, it seems like they should be better with him in the lineup, and they haven't been. They've had a ton of injuries. They have not had a lot of lineup stability. They've been without Hero for a while. And, you know, weirdly, lately, this losing streak, I think they've missed Kevin Love a lot more than they've missed Hero. Because A, Love's been awesome, and B, they just don't have any good backup center options other than him. So that's been like the bigger issue to me. And Hero, it just feels like when he's out, they never really seem to miss him. And that feels like even more acute now that they have Rozier. Those two guys did not mesh well together at all. Rozier's played quite a bit better since Hero went out. So there's that. There's this Duncan Robinson evolution, which I'm just amazed by every time I watch him. He's now like, I mean, he's still hitting a ton of threes, like a ton of DHO threes like he's always done, but he's running like twice as much pick and roll as he has in any other season, driving the ball about three times as frequently as he ever has before, by far the highest assist rate of his career. You know, he's leveraging overplays into backdoor cuts. He's driving closeouts. He's keeping his dribble alive and getting to the rim and making some really productive passes, like just looking like a much more well-rounded player who, if his jump shot abandons him for a game or two, he's still able to provide a lot of value. And so I put a lot of stock in that. I do feel vindicated, though, in not being super excited about the Rozier acquisition, because I just don't think, as much as he has played better lately, I don't think he's been it for them. And the big question I had, we were talking about like his pull-up jump shooting stats and his pick-and-roll efficiency when he came over. And I was like, the big question I have is, are defenses going to treat him that way, and is he going to be able to get two on the ball in pick-and-roll? And in Miami, that has decidedly not been the case.
Yeah,
all of his pick-and-rolls are getting defended two-on-two. He's not creating a ton of advantages out of that. I think his passing in those situations is like okay, but not to the point where if there's like a micro advantage there, he's going to find it and it's going to snowball into something bigger. It's like a lot of resets, or it's a pocket pass to Bam for a short roll jumper, or it's him kind of forcing a pull-up mid-ranger or a floater. Like, it just hasn't looked that great to me, and it still feels like he's a bit of a squeaky wheel in that offense, like playing outside the flow a little bit. And so, yeah, I just don't know. Like, I don't know what it looks like when Hero comes back. I think one of those guys is going to have to come off of the bench.
I don't know who it is
or who it should be, but like,
because I think Robinson was coming off the bench when they first acquired Rozier, right? But for all of the reasons you already mentioned, I think Duncan Robinson has to stay in the starting lineup. I think he's less intrusive of a scorer than Rozier.
Yes.
Or Hero. I think he just functions better within the system Eric Spoelstra likes to run. One of Hero or Rozier, probably Hero, should be starting. Bring Rozier off the bench. I don't know what that looks like, but I think it's a snugger fit than having both him and Hero in the starting five together. I don't think that makes much sense. You mentioned the injuries. Like, I do think it's possible a big part of the inconsistency this season, even though I get what you're saying, where like they haven't been that good even with Jimmy in the lineup, I do think a big part of the inconsistency is how rarely they've been whole this season. If you look, you know, Spotrek tracks injuries not just by total games missed, but also they filter it by like, you know, what a contract a guy's on, and then you can filter it by kind of like value missed in terms of a dollar amount, just somewhat give you an idea of which teams are missing better players. So the Heat have lost the fourth most total games to injury and the sixth most value to injury if you go by contract. So they've been one of the more injured teams all year. They've only played 404 minutes all season with all three of Butler, Bam, and Hero on the court, in those 404 minutes, plus 5.1 per 100 possessions. It's in line with about a top five-ish team in a given year. So I think it's possible, had they been healthy, we'd see something.
Also, with when you're talking about like a team's top three players, yes, right?
You should be better than plus five. I was going to say that.
Yeah.
But I think it's possible, have you know, they've been mostly healthy all year, we'd see something closer to the team that went on the run they went on last year. Now, in terms of Rozier, as you know, I was much higher on the pickup than you were based on some of the things he had shown this season in Charlotte. His first 10 games with the Heat were god-awful. His assist numbers looked good, but like if you watched those games, it was a lot of fluff in terms of the assist numbers and like just not good basketball. Some of the worst defense I've seen him play in a long time. Like just all around was not good. His efficiency had tanked. Then he misses a few weeks with a sprained knee. Comes back. Statistically now, since returning, looks like the player that I was excited to see join the Heat back in January. Last eight games, he's averaged roughly 18.6 assists, four rebounds and a steal, shooting 52% inside the arc, 39% from deep. And during that time, second on the team in scoring, second in assists, third in minutes behind Butler and Bam. So you could look at that and be like, okay, he's rounding at the form, he's healthy, since coming back, this is the player they acquired, they get Hero back, everything's good. But to your point, if you watch this team, and I don't just mean because of the losses they've taken recently, but just like, even with Rozier putting those numbers up and looking healthier, the offense just does not have the same flow that we're used to. And Rozier has not helped that. He's made it worse. And that's why I just think once Hero's back, you definitely can't have both those guys starting lineup. You definitely should keep Duncan Robinson in the lineup. And then I don't know, like I still think there's a role here, obviously, for Rozier. Like if they bring him off the bench, I think he can be a really solid reserve for them and give them valuable minutes off the bench, even in the playoffs. But like I don't think he's capable of filling the role that I envision for him in Miami, and probably that the Heat envision for him too.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess like Hero coming back, they'll want to ease him in and maybe he'll start off coming off the bench. And then maybe once we get to the playoffs, they flip that. But I do think, to your point, Robinson should stay, both because, as you mentioned, he fits better within their offensive system. And also, I don't want to say he's less of a liability defensively than Rozier, because I do think Rozier has been pretty good defending at the point of attack the last couple weeks. But he's definitely less of a liability than Hero. And when he gets targeted defensively, it just looks different than when Hero gets targeted. Robinson's gotten really good at doing the hedge and recover thing to stay out of switches. But also Miami's a little bit more willing to give that switch with him. And I think they're more comfortable, and justifiably so, like leaving him on an island, because he's been decent in those situations. I think having both Hero and Rozier out there together is just tough. And, you know, it's funny, like I heard, I think it was Nekias Duncan making this point on a pod recently where he was like, Rozier's getting hunted on defense a lot more lately and a lot more than I would have expected. And it's like, well, yeah, because Hero's gone. Like Hero's not playing. When they were playing together, it was like Hero was the guy that everyone was going after. I remember specifically a game against the Knicks when Rozier was the primary on Jalen Brunson. And Brunson was like, no, not you. I want him. And just bringing Hero into action over and over and over again and trying to get that matchup. So when Hero's not there, now Rozier is like the weak spot that opponents are trying to prod at. And I think he's held his own. He's been pretty good. And I think with Robinson, you just don't have those same kind of defensive questions because of his size, because I think he's a bit of a smarter positional defender than Hero is. So I like that look better. And one of Hero or Rozier, again, to me, is going to have to come off the bench when it comes down to it. But
yeah, I think one of the indicators, too, that kind of aligns with the eye test of that flow just not being there, despite Rozier's numbers being pretty solid since he's come back from injury, is, and I put this in that piece we did about like how all the kind of new faces and new places are doing. But, you know, you would have figured, based on where he was coming from in Charlotte, and A, just the lack of talent there, but the injuries they had and like all the things Terry Rozier had to do there and the self-creation that he needed to survive offensively in Charlotte. You would have thought coming to Miami, obviously more talent around him, a much more movement heavy system, ball and off ball. Like you'd think the burden would be greatly eased in Miami. And yet he is actually creating more of his field goals so far in Miami than he did in Charlotte. And I think that's really interesting. And again, I think that aligns with kind of what we're seeing with our own eyes, where it's like something just doesn't seem right. It's a little bit of like square peg round hole right now with Rozier in the Heat, where it's like, it's not even that he's playing poorly anymore. It's just that it doesn't quite fit. And I'm really interested to see how it might fit if he is coming off the bench for them in a reduced role, or maybe it just doesn't. Like sometimes players and teams just don't work together. And I think if anyone can figure it out, Eric Spoelstra, I'm sure, you know, has his ideas, but I do think a decision is going to have to be made when Hero comes back. And I think the right one is probably moving Rozier to the bench.
Yeah. And I remember saying at the time, like, I think sneakily the Heat are going to miss a lot of things that Kyle Lowry does. And I still think that this was the right decision for them. You know, whether Rozier was the right guy to target, I guess, is another matter. We don't have to get into that. But like, this still gives them more upside, I think, than they would have had with Lowry. So I still back it. But in terms of like that flow, having a guy who is going to get off the ball, going to make good connective passes. And also, you know, the Jimmy Kyle pick and roll was sort of a big part of the Heat offense early in the season. Like that was, he really liked to use Lowry as a screening partner. And it just hasn't been that same way with Rozier, who's nowhere near the screener that Lowry is. So little things like that, I think, you know, they are missing Lowry's impact and the particular skill set that he brought and struggling a little bit to integrate Rozier. But I just think with the offensive limitations with Lowry, they still needed to make this type of a move to give themselves a bit more offensive upside. But I think, you know, if there's one thing that's disappointed me with Rozier, it's like I don't think that he has brought the kind of rim pressure that they were hoping for from him. Like I mentioned before, they're 29th in rim frequency. I don't think he's really moved the needle in that regard. I don't think his drives are putting a ton of pressure on defenses. Man, honestly, like there are games when genuinely Duncan Robinson is both the best pick and roll operator and the number one source of rim pressure for the Heat. And that reflects well on him and his growth, but it's a big problem and a big red flag also, because, you know, the thing with Duncan in pick and roll is like, yes, he can consistently get two on the ball in a way nobody else on the Heat really can. But if the defense is proactive about tagging and like taking away Bam on the roll, or at least limiting Bam on the roll to like short roll jumpers, Duncan is not the guy who's going to consistently like make that skip pass to the weak side. As far as he's come as a passer, he's not at that level. So that's where you run into these issues where it's just, you can't rely on Duncan Robinson to be your best pick and roll operator. You know, like that's, I have these concerns about whether their offense is actually going to be able to level up this time around. You know, I have no real concerns about their defense, even though like we're talking through these issues about Rozier, Hero, like we've seen time and again, having Jimmy and Bam as anchors is going to give you a really high defensive floor in the playoffs. And Bam, I think, has been fantastic defensively this season. Like, as with the Mavs, you don't question the Mavs offense. You just wonder about whether their defense can get to another level. And it's the same with the Heat, but with their offense. And, you know, I just don't know. But one more lineup question I have, I guess, is like, they're not going to go into the playoffs with Jovic in the starting lineup, right? Like, is that really the plan?
I don't know, man.
Like, what?
Well, I'm not arguing he should remain in the lineup. I'm just saying, at this point, he's been in it for a while. Obviously, one of the guards will come out when Hero comes, but
why is that not Caleb Martin's starting?
Oh, I agree.
Like, you know, I mean, it's tricky. Like, sometimes guys are just more comfortable in a certain role, or like a coach likes having them come off the bench for one reason or another. managing the flow of the game, things that like I'm, you know, I don't have to worry about. But like, why Caleb Martin's been really good, I think, when he's played this year. I don't understand why he's not starting.
Me neither. All right, you know what I think might be a good way to kind of tie this all together? I'm not going to ask which team out of the two we talked about today do you have more faith in to play spoiler, because I think some of that will just be dependent. Like, the East is shittier, and we know that, and maybe that gives Miami the better chance. But here's a fun one for you. If these two teams matched up in a play, and I don't mean they make the final, I just mean just in a make-believe world where they could play in the playoffs right now. If these two teams matched up in a playoff series, where would you lean?
Dallas.
I'd lean Miami.
It's interesting because they actually played each other not that long ago. So this jumped out to me in that game because it was one of those games where there were probably 12 to 15 coverage breakdowns that I saw from the Mavs. And there were almost none from Miami. And it didn't matter because the shot-making deficit was so extreme. And the Mavs did just enough defensively, and the Heat missed enough of the open shots that they got as a result of those Mavs coverage breakdowns that Luka was able to just take over at the other end of the floor, and that carried them through. And that's just kind of what it would come down to me. Like, the Mavs are able to survive some of those breakdowns because of the firepower that they have. And the Heat aren't really able to take advantage of coverage breakdowns because they don't have enough offensively. Like, they need to be perfect defensively, and then they need to level up on offense. Like, they can be perfect defensively and it still not be enough. This was the case against Denver the other night too. They were amazing defensively and it didn't matter. They lost by double digits because they scored 88 points. So that's why I think, not to over-index on that one regular season game, but it's just a feeling that I have of like, I would trust the team that can consistently put the ball in the basket more than this Miami team can right now.
Yeah, that's fair. But I think the playoff Heat offense, as you are well aware, for whatever reason, is a different animal. And I think these teams are actually like very evenly matched. And the numbers confirm that. But, you know, I think Luka's the best player between the two teams for sure. But again, in a playoff setting and the game Jimmy Butler takes his game to on both ends, I think the gap is much narrower in the playoffs, if it exists at all. Maybe Jimmy's probably the better player in terms of the playoffs when you talk about both ends. And I think if it's close enough and the Heat's offense levels up the way it usually does in the postseason, as we've seen, you know, three out of the last 4 years with the similar makeup, and I start thinking about, like, what do I trust and not trust, I think I would trust the Heat's offense to level up more than I would trust the Mavs to figure things out defensively. And I think it'd be a close enough matchup where then I'd just come down to, like, the Mavs are bringing a Jason Kidd to an Eric Spoelstra fight, you know? Like, it's just...
That's fair. And I'm not, you know, if that was the rationale, I would be like, you know what? That makes sense. I just don't want to do the thing where I'm like, yeah, the Heat have looked mid basically all year, but because of what we've seen them do in the playoffs in the past, we have to pick them. I think that's valid, but I don't think that it's the way that I want to think about this, because I like to believe that what we see over the course of an 82-game regular season actually does matter. And as much as I have definitely come around to believing there is something different about the Heat in the playoffs, I think there is also still an element of shot-making variance that has made it look more extreme, you know, the leap from regular season to playoff Heat, more extreme than it actually is. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if what we see from them in the playoffs this year is more akin to what we saw in 2021 when they get summarily dispatched and it's like, oh, maybe we should have just believed our eyes when we saw what this team was throughout the last 5 months. That's where I'm at. Okay, Heat and Mavs, always good fodder for conversation.
For the last 18 years, it has been.
Yeah. Teams to watch down the stretch, definitely, and potential spoilers to watch moving ahead to the playoffs. But as of now, they're both in play-in spots, so they have to get there first. Let's leave all that there. Do we have a fan shout-out this week, Cash?
Yeah, we've got another comedic one. Okay. That's more complaint than anything, but it's from a loyal listener who I think we might have shouted out before, but this is actually a couple months in the making. I keep forgetting to give him another shout out just based on how hilarious the very, very long email he sent to me was, and I'm not going to get into the whole thing. His name's Brett Benton from Roseville, California. He is a Lakers fan and was upset because he felt we weren't... Funny enough to fans that aren't Lakers fans, because they're going to roll their eyes and maybe throw up in their mouth a little bit about this, but Brett Benton said that we actually haven't talked about the Lakers enough, and that he thought there was a period this season where he thought we were somehow going out of our way to not talk about the Lakers. He has, again, I literally can't get into this email because it's too long, but he's got like examples like in this show, you talked about this and it was like a segue to the Lakers and you still didn't talk about them. And then you like talked about the Celtics and the Knicks and the Warriors in this episode. And you could anyway, very upset that we haven't been talking enough Lakers, or at least he was when he first sent this a couple months ago. Again, I do apologize. I haven't got to this in the last couple months, but here is the kicker, Wolfwan. And I think you will appreciate this, even if you don't appreciate the general reason why Brent emailed. And that is that he ends it with a photo of a sign. This must have been during election season in Roseville, California, and there must have been a mayoral election. And he took a picture of a candidate whose name was Christina Fugazi. And so it says Fugazi for mayor. And because Brent was so upset that we haven't talked about the Lakers enough, he says, "I saw the attached photo on the roadside and it made me think of you." It's wow. Just a sign that says Fugazi for mayor. So Brent, despite me not agreeing at all with why you were upset with us, I got to give you kudos for seeing that campaign sign, taking a picture of it on the side of the road. It's like in a bunch of weeds and dead grass, and sending it to me to cap that email. It made me forget everything else that was in the email and just laugh. And I can't believe it's taken a couple months for us to get to this shout out. And I know it's funny that now 2 weeks in a row, our fan shout outs have actually been people who were complaining, but I had to do it.
So if you're keeping track, in the last couple weeks, we've been accused of being a Philly fan cast, of deliberately avoiding talking about the Lakers. And now we've gone like an hour and 10 minutes just talking about the Heat and Mavericks. So I don't know if there's a unified theory of Pound the Rock that you can take from all of that, but I think it should let you know that what we actually like to do is spread things around and give every team its just due. And I mean, I apologize if we haven't given the Lakers their due this season, but I think from where I sit, we have talked about them exactly as much as a 35 and 31 team deserves to be talked about. And like, maybe that should skew in a different direction because they have LeBron James in the twilight of his career, but they haven't been as relevant, frankly, as some of the other teams that we've given more attention to this year. So let's leave it on that note. And we'll come back next week and we'll make some more people upset by refusing to talk about their favorite teams. How does that sound, Cash?
Absolutely wonderful. Wouldn't want to do it with anyone else.
All right. With that, we're signing off. We'll talk to y'all next week. For Mayor Fugazi, I'm Joe Wolfon. Pound the Rock.